Let me begin today by making it clear that I stand for justice for all Americans. We all should. Police brutality was evident in the George Floyd case, and I support the decision to bring charges against the four officers involved. It is true that George Floyd was no hero to emulate. He had a long criminal record in Texas before moving to Minneapolis. That being said, the man had apparently turned over a new leaf with his move to Minnesota, and he did not deserve to die as he did. The policemen who caused the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis have seen their charges moved up from third degree to second degree murder. Additionally, the other three officers have now been charged with aiding and abetting murder. Those calling for justice are seeing justice being done, but the marches continue. We also need to remember that more than 50 police officers, 50, were killed on duty in 2019. There were also 10 unarmed blacks killed by police in 2019, far less than died in 2015 when Barack Hussein Obama was president. I give credit to Jack Fisher of Black America Web for his research, which I incorporate with my own in this commentary. I normally issue a weekly commentary on Fridays. This past week, I issued a bonus commentary on Monday because of the anarchy over the death of a black man in Minneapolis under the knee of a white rogue policeman. That action prompted protests across America. The protesters shouted that Black Lives Matter and that a black man had been killed by a white policeman. I joined with those who were appalled at the video of a policeman with his knee on this man's neck for 8 minutes and 40 seconds, even after the man was no longer able to move and there was no pulse. Very few white people were not appalled, and they joined the call for justice. But sources in the black community and the media could not wait for justice to be administered. They immediately took to the streets in protest, shouting, "No justice, no peace." It took officials just 3 days to arrest the officer in question and to press charges against him. 3 days. The other three officers were also fired, and an investigation was launched into their part in the crime. There had to be an investigation first. Was it too slow, as the protesters claimed? Remember, just a few short years ago, in Minneapolis, a black policeman had killed a white woman, and it was 8 months of investigation before that black policeman was arrested and charged. Moreover, I said earlier that in 2019, there were 10 unarmed black people killed by police. In that same year, 19 unarmed white people were killed by the police. That is more than double the number of blacks killed compared to whites who died at the hands of law enforcement. Nobody stopped to consider that, and the mainstream media will not report on it. When the video appeared showing the policeman with his knee on George Floyd's neck, I joined with 99% of Americans who were disgusted. The video was vivid and disturbing. The point had been made about this officer's lack of concern for human life, not black lives. Human lives. All sympathy was on the side of the need for racial reform. But then the protest marches began. Peacefully at first. But in the blink of an eye, the anarchists among the marchers began to burn buildings, loot businesses, and practice violence. It was at that point that all peaceful marchers should have left the crowd. Instead, many of them have served as a shield for the brick throwers in the back, holding up their hands and blocking the police. Once you remain with anarchists, you are no longer in a peaceful protest. I'm old enough to remember the remarkable results that Martin Luther King brought about during the civil rights struggle. I began my radio career in a small Alabama town where a large number of black residents lived. MLK's wife, Coretta King, was born there. George Wallace was governor, and the civil rights struggle was not getting much traction. Dr. King realized that violence begets violence, and the way to bring the American people around to understand what was happening in America was to let the white racists among us do the job themselves. King advocated and practiced nonviolence, even when provoked or beaten by those opposing civil rights for black people. Had Dr. King resorted to the violence, burnings, and lootings we've seen following the George Floyd case, the cause for civil rights would have been derailed. Instead, he wisely urged his followers to turn the other cheek, even when it hurt to do so. Suddenly, thanks to television, the American people could see the problem. Fire hoses turned on peaceful demonstrators. Snarling dogs unleashed against defenseless people. Those protesters were not carrying guns, bricks, gasoline, or matches. They were not looting stores or burning buildings, and yet law enforcement was denying them their very basic human rights. Dr. King had done what no others before him knew to do. He held up a mirror to show the injustice instead of smashing the mirror over the head of the police. Americans took note, and civil rights laws were enacted. I lived through that, and I was a witness to the injustice. While Martin Luther King was not a perfect man, he had flaws, as we all do, and his critics loudly pointed out those flaws. He was the man for the times. Today's protesters would do well to take a page from Dr. King's book of tactics. I'm old enough to remember walking those sidewalks in Marion, Alabama, in the early 60s, and having elderly black people step into the street to let this young white boy pass. They were conditioned to not look at me, not look in the eyes. I remember vividly the shame I felt at the time. Not for anything I had done. Even then I addressed my black elders as sir and ma'am. But shame for a racist society that had to change. The key to that change was not resorting to violence, but showing the country where it was wrong through TV sets in living rooms across America. This has been a very troubling time for me because I was not raised to hate. But hatred in America is not confined to white people. As disgusting as the death of George Floyd was, masses gathered to protest the lone death of a black man in Minneapolis. Why? Because it was caused by a white man. While in Chicago, every weekend brings mayhem, and many blacks are shot and murdered by other blacks, not just one. The difference is that Mr. Floyd died under the knee of a white policeman. The multiple blacks who were shot weekly in Chicago and other cities by other blacks does not rate the same news, and there are no protest marches for the dead in Chicago. Why? Because those dead black people were not killed by white people. They die every weekend at the hands of black shooters. Last weekend, more than 80 people were shot in Chicago. 19 black people lost their lives. 19, not just one. Do those black lives not matter because they were taken by black men? Instead, in America, there are two camps of people divided by skin color who distrust each other and shout instead of talking. I am a white man. I had no hand in deciding to make my skin white. I don't pretend to understand what it's like to be a black person in this country or elsewhere in the world, but I do want to understand it. I'm willing to listen with a pure heart, but no one seems to want to talk that way. While I see the death of George Floyd as a horrendous example of police brutality that must and will result in justice for the victim, I also see that there are almost 700,000 law enforcement officers, black, white, Asian, Latino, and even a few Native American Indians trying to keep law and order in our country. It is inevitable that in this vast number, we won't find a few, a very small few, bad cops. But we do not see a far larger number of bad civilians because the media will not discuss it. Could it be possible that the urge to view blacks in a bad light by the police have to do with young black men who create much more of the crimes than their share of the population and who hate the police? That there is an unspoken law in black communities that all blacks must be protected and no one is to cooperate with the police, even when you have known hoodlums among you. Of course, none of that is meant to excuse brutality by law enforcement. I hope you'll indulge me for a moment as I delve into my own life history. That's my only frame of reference. I relive these painful memories to show that poor white people have mountains to climb, just like blacks. There were 9 people living in our home, my mother and father, 4 brothers, a sister, and my father's brother, who had lived with us for as long as I can remember. We certainly did not benefit from any mythical white privilege. My father was a body and fender repairman in a garage and never made much money. My mother worked when times got too tight, but had her hands full with 6 children. We lived from paycheck to paycheck. To compound our problems, my parents and uncle abused alcohol most weekends, and ugly mayhem was visited upon us. Physical fights were commonplace, while the children looked on in horror. That leaves emotional scars. My parents were not well educated. My father had to drop out of school after the 3rd grade to help feed his family. He was born in 1922. My mother completed the 6th grade in Smithfield. They were good and decent people who were overwhelmed with poverty and the needs to raise 6 children. We did not live in a big city, and so there was no ghetto for us, just dilapidated houses where we moved often. By the time I was 18, the family had moved 36 times. Most of those houses would be condemned by today's standards. Nobody would be allowed to live in them. I remember one shack that was so overrun by large rats, we called it the Rat Shack. We weren't there because we loved rats. It was all we could afford. At age 18, desperate to escape the poverty, I joined the Navy. With my background, what are the odds that I would build a successful career, become financially independent and self-educated? For the record, when their stress level was eased, my parents gave up alcohol and cigarettes and became good, church-going Christians. I'm proud of them for that accomplishment. It was not easy. So I understand what it's like to be poor and undereducated. What I don't understand is the lack of a burning desire to rise above all that. We live in the greatest country in the world where anything is possible. If the individual has the desire and perseverance, nothing can stand in their way. It's not easy. It's not quick. And having a white skin earned me nothing at all. There were no government programs to prop me up. Many Americans can identify with the life I have just described. My best friend through school came from a family that fared even worse than mine. They lived in a converted service station that had seen its better days. They had a very small galley kitchen, which led into the main room where there were two double beds and two beat-up armoires serving as closets. Lastly, there was a small bathroom. They had no shower, no tub, just a sink where they could clean themselves with washcloths. That white boy and his family never benefited from some mythical white privilege. As poor kids, we were looked down upon by many in town. Being white didn't help us avoid that. My point is that poor people, be they black or white, have a harder row to hoe in life. Poor, not just black. To overcome, they have to exert greater effort and learn never to give in. My friend that was with me in school from the first grade became the mayor of his town. To my mind, here are the four common problems holding back black Americans today. First, lack of family structure. More than 70% of all black children are illegitimate, and that number is rising every year. In 1963, welfare became a right, according to the Constitution, which made husbands and fathers redundant. They weren't needed. Too many black American families grow up without a father figure in the house, which often leads to psychological issues later in life. Secondly, dangerous cities like Oakland, Cleveland, Baltimore, Chicago, and Detroit, where gang violence and crime is an everyday occurrence, have a high population of black Americans who live under the rule of Democrats. Third, high abortion rates. It is estimated that almost 40% of all abortions in this country are done by black American women. This heightened loss of uncounted lives percolates to reduce respect for life and has played a role in decreasing civility with which people treat each other. Fourth, the victim mindset. Nothing holds a black American back more than seeing themselves as a victim who sees everything as somebody else's fault without taking the deserved responsibility to such significant degree that their victim status becomes their collective identity. And fifth, studies have shown that more than 55% of homicides are committed by black Americans, who are just 13% of the population. Due to crime and a high incarceration rate, every 1 in 9 black children you pass on the sidewalk may have or might have had a parent in prison. Due to the greater likelihood of black Americans being incarcerated, their social upbringing and family structure has taken its toll. By all means, let's have a real dialogue about race in this country. To do so, the hate and vitriol has to be set aside. I, for one, want to understand the feelings of black Americans. I want to see us take whatever steps are called for to heal old wounds and address any grievances about police brutality. Black America will achieve that goal much quicker by following Dr. King's example of nonviolence. It's not enough to march with your hands up while you see and tolerate the looters and arsonists among you. People calling themselves peaceful protesters are providing anarchists with an excuse to destroy the country and a crowd within which to hide. We can all agree upon equal treatment for each other, but not at the point of a sword. Protest marches are to bring attention to a problem. From the get-go, full national attention has been focused on the problem of police brutality. So why do day after day marches continue? Why shout no justice, no peace when justice has already arrested and charged the officer in Minneapolis and it's headed for trial? The prosecutor will be a black man, the attorney general. We as individuals don't get to decide what justice is. We have courts for that. I've seen marchers say that they won't stop marching until these policemen are behind bars for life. I've seen others call for them to be killed. I've moved from disgust with the killing of George Floyd to disgust for those prolonging our nation's agony. The point has been made. Justice is underway. It is time to go home and prepare to go to work. Just how long do you beat a dead horse? Is there not some point where the flogging becomes counterproductive? We have reached that point days ago. No country on earth has done more to combat racism than the United States. There is much more to do, but it won't get done marching in the streets or looting stores. Who wants to give an answer for ending racial strife in America? That's what we should be talking about. That's the subject at hand. According to the founder of Black Entertainment Television, the answer is to steal more than $350,000 for each black person in America from taxpayers and give it over to blacks in reparations. We have spent more than $33 trillion over the last 50 years trying to atone for slavery, and we're right back where we started. The answer is not more giveaways. Education is one. Demanding personal responsibility and self-initiative is another. You are a victim in America only if you choose to be one. Enough already. Save the shoe leather and use our brains. Predictably, Joe Biden has used the Minneapolis horror politically. He blames President Trump for George Floyd's death. But Joe Biden, Nancy Pelosi, and Chuck Schumer have been in power in Washington for more than 100 years, and still the problem persists. Biden has said that he would cure the problem in his first 100 days in office. This from a man who has been in the United States Senate for decades and never had an answer to the problem. Suddenly, if we will make him president, he will perform a miracle that he was not able to perform in 30 years in office. COVID-19 is still among us. We watch these marches going on, some with masks, some without, some distancing, most not. If distancing and being around people not wearing a mask are as dangerous as we're being told it is, there should be a tremendous number of COVID-19 victims among these marchers. If there is no large increase in COVID-19 deaths in those crowds, we will know that we have been scammed, and we will demand to be able to go back to work. You cannot keep the American economy chained up forever. We've seen the idiocy of people like Bill de Blasio in New York, who had a curfew of 9 o'clock and who decided he'd just extend that till 11 o'clock. His own daughter was arrested for violating the curfew, a curfew he set in place, and he congratulated her for breaking the law. That's the kind of mentality we're dealing with among Democrats. I don't pretend that Republicans are perfect either. We have some Republicans, thank God not that many, who are standing on the sidelines trying to defeat President Donald Trump. The big problem, of course, is with Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, not Joe Biden. Joe Biden has wanted to be president for 60 years. But in those 60 years, Joe Biden's thinking has gone awry. The man is in the early stages of dementia, and it's obvious to anybody. He even says that he's got to be careful picking his vice president, because that vice president will probably be our president within the first 4 years. Biden himself doesn't think he's going to make it in a 4-year term. That says, look carefully at that vice president. Lately, they've been ballyhooing Kamala Harris. Google that name, Kamala Harris. Is that who you want to be your president? She was running for the Democratic nomination. Democrats themselves left her in the cold and chose Joe Biden. We live in a strange world, folks. Thanks for listening. I'll be back again next week, God willing. Same time and same station.